Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Today we have an example of the worst of race relations in our region, the bloody race riots of East St. Louis in 1917. The community is observing the centennial of that event that was actually a series of conflicts that scarred the community for decades. Joining me to take a closer look at this history, Charles Lumpkins is professor of African and African-American Studies at Pennsylvania State University. He is the author of American Pogrom, the East St. Louis Race Riot and Black Politics. He will be joining us by phone momentarily. Andrew Theising is associate professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville. Tiffany Lee is the co-author of Legendary East St. Louisans. Professor, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
We look forward to seeing you in St. Louis a little bit later in the week, and we'll talk about that momentarily. But if I may start with you, could you kind of set the stage for us as to what was going on in 1917 that caused this turmoil?
Yes, I will. Several factors have to be taken into consideration when the conflict erupted with much fury in July of 1917. A, the black population of East St. Louis dramatically increased during what we now call the Great Migration, when thousands upon thousands of black Southerners, hundreds of thousands, left the South and moved to the Midwestern and Northern cities for industrial jobs in the booming war economy. And of course, that meant for some type of interracial competition for jobs and housing. Now, other things were going on at the same time. The black population of East St. Louis was increasing noticeably before 1916, which is usually the start of the Great Migration, 1915, by 1910. And so the black politics part comes into play when black political activists, politicians, any St. Louis who have been playing or who have been doing things like swing voting, getting the black population to swing their votes to favor one side or the other in exchange for improved services and access to resources, realized by 1910 that if the trend continued, they could establish their own political machine instead of being subservient to any one of the factions that was white-dominated. Now, other factors were going on as well, namely the what I identified as, or at least as I labeled, the politician businessmen in the city who centered around real estate development, land speculation. And they had their eyes on certain areas of the city in order to improve real estate for commercial and residential purposes. And other factors were going on at the same time as well. But things did come to a head in 1917 when there were two what people call race riots. I call them pogroms for other reasons, but two of them broke out in the city. The one in May 28 of 1917, and of course the one, the famous or infamous one, that broke out on July 2nd and 3rd of the same year. Very rarely do historians have something that could be like a controlled subject in like a historical laboratory, so to speak. And hence, basically the same actors, the same players were there in July as they were as in May of 34 days before in May of 1917. And what went on was that in May, of course, as far as we know, no one was killed, very little property damage. Stark contrast to, well, the official number, of course, 48 individuals, of whom 39 were black, were killed. Property damage at that time estimated into the millions. Many homes were destroyed. At least 7,000 black residents became permanently exiled from East St. Louis, and a number of other factors happened as well. So the trigger incident was when a black self-defense, a non-black self-defense group, a neighborhood watch group, you may want to call it, basically were out patrolling their part of the neighborhood in the city's Denver Side section, and they ran into, or I should say, a car, an unmarked police car, bearing five individual white men, two of whom were plainclothes police detectives, ran into, well, came across the defense group. Now, estimates said up to 150 black men were in that group. Well, anyway, the people in the defense group thought there was just another group of drive-by shooters, since the black community was experiencing drive-by shooting by unknown, unnamed white individuals during the month of June, between the May pogrom and what became the July pogrom. Well, they shot and killed two of the plainclothes police detectives, and
That got it going.
And that was the trigger incident. That was the trigger incident that set off the fighting, because the police department there, many of the police officers, of course, were enraged at that what happened to their colleagues, and refused or were very reluctant to protect black citizens, whereas they did protect black citizens back in May. Now, I mentioned the self-defense group, and that and the other individuals who were armed in the Denver Side section prevented that section from being totally destroyed by mobs of white assailants. Most of the black-owned homes or black-occupied homes and businesses that were destroyed were outside of Denver Side, in and around the downtown district, especially on the west side of the downtown district. What would be now, well, used to be 2nd Street, 1st Street, 2nd Street, part of 3rd Street in East St. Louis.
All right. Now, we've established that, and there's lots to talk about, but I want to get the other guests into the program. Andrew Theising, let me turn to you first. It seems to me like this was a perfect storm that was brewing prior to the violence.
It really was a perfect storm, and these events did not sneak up on us, that everybody knew something big was coming. And the labor disputes had been going on. The newspaper headlines for the preceding year had been very, very inflammatory about Negro colonization. And it was just conflated with all of this public talk and rumors and talk about fake news. There was quite a bit of it back then, and it just stirred the wrong emotions in people.
Right. Tiffany, what of this is left with us today, if anything?
As it relates to current events?
Well, as people view it now, is this history well known today, particularly by young people, for instance, or by residents of East St. Louis in general?
No. Unfortunately, it has not been well known in this area. It's kind of it hasn't been taught in school. It has not become a regular part of just what we know about East St. Louis. Unfortunately, I didn't learn about this until I was in college. So we're trying to rectify that, though. We have been in an effort to educate the public, educate students, college students, and younger students about these atrocities that occurred.
Andrew, is this something, I'll ask you, with us today? In other words, have there been ramifications? Is there impact? Is there something of today that is representative of what happened a century ago?
I think so. I think there are quite a few remnants. Of course, we still in this region suffer from racism and segregation. Mm-hmm. Those issues are still with us, unfortunately. But it was out of this riot that came the Urban League's presence in the greater St. Louis area, and what a positive force the Urban League has been. This was when the founders of the ACLU, which used to be here, Roger Baldwin lived here in St. Louis, went to New York, was so appalled at what he saw, started the ACLU. And so, again, there's another force, a positive force that came out of this. So I do think that we have both good and bad that are with us today.
This, Professor Lumpkins, this is something that people all over the country became very much aware of.
As far as the riots were concerned,
yeah.
Yes. It was splashed across newspapers throughout the nation. Many of the newspapers, editorials and letters to the newspapers and such, expressed horror that this happened, especially in the state of Lincoln, Illinois, is Lincoln's home state and such. How could it happen? So on and so forth. And, of course, the reasons for the people cited different reasons for the riot, like the labor disputes, political corruption, black criminality, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Whether or not, it depends on, of course, the perspectives of the individuals who talked and so forth as far as, why the riot happened. And, of course, in the southern states, they said that, yeah, here, an example, racism just as widespread in the north as in the south, and it behooves black southerners who went north to move back to the south. Of course, many of these southerners who were talking that way wanted to see their labor force return instead of leaving permanently the southern states. And others cited the fact that Woodrow Wilson, who talked so eloquently about making the world safe for democracy during World War I, well, in fact, there's an iconic editorial cartoon showing a black mother with, I believe, two of her children looking at President Woodrow Wilson, and basically the caption, I believe, said, if memory serves me well, why not make St. Louis safe for democracy, or make America safe for democracy. That type of sentiment was picked up and expressed by many individuals across the country. Now, because of the fact that the city of East St. Louis, an industrial city, sat on the boundaries of two states, that allowed Congress to step in to investigate the riot because it interrupted interstate transport, which included a valuable war material, since the only since East St. Louis was the home of a strategic industrial plant, the Aluminum Ore Company, the only bauxite processing ore company in all of North America, and that was considered very valuable for the war effort. So another reason for them to step in to investigate the riots, see what went on, and so on and so forth. So as your two guests have said, and I highly concur with them, the East St. Louis pogrom have so much to teach us. It's like a precursor to even today's developments, today's events, and race relations in general.
I have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more specifically
yes.
about what was going on. But I just want to make the point, we're beginning to learn a lot more about Woodrow Wilson these days, because my impression is that they want to remove at his Princeton University some of the Wilson recollections, if you will, given his attitude toward the races. We'll come back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation about those race riots in East St. Louis in 1917. My guests are Professor Charles Lumpkins of Pennsylvania State University. He joins us by phone. Andrew Theising is of Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville. And Tiffany Lee is an author and historian. They join me in studio. Professor Lumpkins, let me come back to you, because I was struck in reading about this with the brutality. I mean, no riot is without its violence, but the brutality, particularly in the July riots, seemed especially troublesome.
Yes. Reading about it, one gets a sense of shock and a feeling of horror, no doubt about it. But then, of course, I have to step back and say, I've read, and I'm sure everyone you and the others in the audience there have read reports of lynchings and how brutal those lynchings were, where people would take body parts or, you know, or just subject the victims to incredible forms of torture or whatever. And so in some ways, the riot and contain, if you want to have, if you look at some individual episodes during the course of the riot, you would see actual lynchings or behavior that takes place at lynchings going on in the city. So the shock value was basically it took place in a city. It took place in an industrialized city. It took place in a city in a state that proclaimed, if not racial equality, then fairness, racial fairness. A city where the black population did engage in political activity, and had some, even though there was some segregation going on in the city. On the other hand, East St. Louisians did have, and it did make an impact culturally and socially in the city. And there, let's see, the horror was that it didn't take place in the South because similar incidents of brutality, whether it was a lynching or even mob violence, they did occur in the South, but the nation said, oh, that's the South. I remember reading something by W.E.B. Du Bois, or where he noticed that the knuckles of a lynching victim was displayed in a store, in a store window, in Atlanta, Georgia, one of the latest lynching victims at the time, that disgusted W.E.B. Du Bois. So it was mass lynching, if you prefer.
Well, and they were burning people alive. I mean, letting people burn to death in their homes. There was, I mean, it's just the carnage is almost indescribable when you stop to think about what was going on. That was a little different. Tiffany Lee, let me turn to you. You've written a book, co-authored a book on legendary East St. Louisans. Are there any legendary East St. Louisans who came out of all of this?
Yes. So a few of the people that are in the book were actually they were there in 1917. So you had John Robinson, who actually in the newspaper report, they talked about him. He was the one who had helped to get schools for African-Americans. They talked about him walking around and trying to help people during the 1917 riots. You had Carrie Bowles, who was actually wife to Professor Bowles, who was a principal at Lincoln High School. And she was actually in one of the first classes, to social work classes, that graduated. She helped people after the riots. You had Mary Martin, who was in the book as well. And she actually, her center helped people after the riots as well. So they helped them with food, clothing, shelter, and so forth.
Yeah. Andrew Theising, this is sort of an aside, but what we're talking about, notables who came out of it. I remember reading Josephine Baker. I just lost the name from her. Josephine Baker, one of the reasons that she went to Paris was because of the East St. Louis riots. Have you heard that story?
Yes. I mean, some people, I think, believe that she was in East St. Louis. I don't know that was actually true, but she always recounted her childhood from standing at the river's edge and watching the city burn, and that just was sort of the start of her consciousness.
Yeah, that's the same story that I heard. She had watched, and the people were coming over from East St. Louis to St. Louis by boat or rowboat or whatever.
any way they could get out.
any means they could find. I want to take a call here. We have, it might be most interesting, John from Troy, Illinois, has some input here. So let's bring him in. John, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
I grew up in East St. Louis. My father was an East St. Louis fireman. And a neighbor of ours, John Culnan, his father was in that car that I guess was the catalyst for the riots. His, as I recall the story, there were five men, five policemen, and they were going to a section of East St. Louis looking for someone specific that, that they wanted to arrest. And they went down a one-way street, not a one-way street, a dead-end street, and then they were fired upon. And all the men, all the policemen in the car, there were five policemen in the car, all of them were shot except Mr. Culnan. And he was able to help the, although he was in the center in the back, he was able to help his fellow policemen get out of there.
Ah, well, thank you for sharing that with us. Professor Lumpkins, that's square with what you've heard.
Okay, well, he provided a few details, like the name of the individual, and that they went down a dead-end street. But overall, right on the money as far as the incident that triggered this the series of events that followed. That there was five men in the car, two planes closed, at least according to the newspaper, I have to state. So what the caller said excites me to know that there are people out there who have parts of the story that haven't made it into history books or into discussion. I've always envisioned that there are people who have a cache of other newspapers, like black-owned newspapers and such, in their attics or basement and waiting to be rediscovered. But overall, the basis of the story that he related sits well with what I have found.
You know, you have, Tiffany, go ahead. You wanted to say something.
I just wanted to add a little bit to that because one of the things that is not acknowledged in this story is the fact that there had been shootings prior to the police officers coming to that area. So you had a police car that came into the area. I mean, you had a car that was similar to the police car that came, and you had the people within that car had actually shot out. That happened at 17th and Market and also 10th and Bond. And so the police were actually coming to investigate those shootings. However, the population that was there was essentially responding to what they thought might possibly be another attack. So I think that needs to be put into context a little.
Yeah, that was a tinderbox. There's no question about what the mood was, both on the part of the police department, which was largely corrupt, Andrew Tysing. Is that not correct?
Yes, all the police officers were political appointees. Yeah. It was not a professional department. There certainly were some officers who were probably better than others at their jobs, but by and large, they were political appointees.
And it was a conflict between the black community, the white workers, and the white police department. Throughout.
Yeah, there were persons of color on the police department. It was not entirely a white police department, but it was certainly majority white, and there was certainly a lot of racist feelings.
But Professor Lumpkins, you have on a couple of occasions, and certainly the title of your book refers to this as a pogrom. When I hear that word, I normally think of such things as the Holocaust. Why do you use that word, and how do you define it in this context?
Okay, I picked up on the use of the word pogrom because various individuals at that time described the event in July as a pogrom. Not only people in the local area in East St. Louis and St. Louis, but even, basically he's not really well known but to us today, but a black activist, a socialist, basically in New York, but he was very prominent in the Socialist Party. Herbert Harrison, originally from the West Indies, also labeled the event as a pogrom. And that word was used even in black newspapers, and not only around the time of just after the race riot, but also before East St. Louis as well. And, of course, all that came from the history of Jewish people from Eastern Europe, basically Tsarist Russia at the time. The reason why I stress use the term pogrom is that the word race riot is too amorphous to describe really specific reasons that made East St. Louis explode and other cities that were experiencing the same thing, but that did not explode. And that was related to the political dynamics and that were going on in East St. Louis in particular at that time, and the black and certain black individuals and groups that wanted to have their fair share of city resources and services and such. So there was a political dimension. And early you mentioned the fact that, okay, black colonization, really that term was used or thrown about numerous times around election time. Black people were being shuttled into East St. Louis and elsewhere to engage in voting, or voting fraud, or whatever. But put in context, it was a bid to reorient political power relationships in that city. It's easier to say race riot because, yeah, most white people and most black people were engaged in fisticuffs and other forms of racial violence toward each other. But the term race riot is used too loosely. The race riots that took place, let's say, in the 1890s, 1900s, the 1910s, are definitely different from what we call race riots, what's been labeled race riots, in the 1960s, 1980s, 1990s, and the 2000s.
Well, this was obviously very different from some of those other things.
So it was my attempt to say, let's sharpen our language to identify what makes this very, very particular. And when you say race riot, it kind of says the history of the word, at least used in the United States, basically says, well, who's to blame? Oh, both races. Or in some cases, they pin the blame for the East St. Louis events on black East St. Louisians,
you know,
as if they want to bring it on themselves.
Excuse me just a second. Our time is beginning to get away from us here. I do want to bring in one caller here because it's relevant to why we're talking about this week. Gregory Carr joins us from St. Louis. Thanks. Gregory, go ahead.
Good afternoon, Dr. Lumpkins, and
good afternoon,
and everyone else. I'm going to be brief.
Please be.
Dr. Lumpkins was here at Harris Stowe State University back in 2008 and did a lecture. And I actually purchased the book at that time, and I told him I was working on a play, and he wrote in my book, make sure you write that play. So at the conference this weekend, we're going to be doing a stage reading of my play called Tinderbox, which
fantastic.
Pretty much puts a family in the middle of this thing, and the two of the family members work for the Lumen Ore Company, and they get there right around the time of the April 18th strike, and then everything kind of goes forward from there.
That's something for people to look forward to. Now I want to bring in Andrew and Tiffany again to talk about the conference. We've got a couple of minutes left. Andrew, why don't you start with what's happening and when?
The academic conference is going to start Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock, and Dr. Lumpkins is going to speak on Friday afternoon. And then on Saturday morning, starting at 9 o'clock, we're going to have some academic panels. Professors and students are going to be presenting some of their work. After lunch, there'll be some memory sharing, there'll be some visioning, and at 2:45 is when Professor Carr's Tinderbox will be staged.
Okay, and there's an essay contest for young people too, as I understand.
There is an essay contest, and students for the last couple weeks have been submitting written work, and we're going to have an announcement of the winner on Friday afternoon.
Okay, well, Tiffany, this all addresses what you brought out at the outset, the need for education, the need for people to understand what went on, what it meant, and maybe a cautionary tale for what might be ahead if we're not careful.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. As it relates to current events, yeah. I think that it's very important that we get educated on this because some of the things that were occurring as far as allegations of voter fraud, immigrants coming into the area allegedly stealing jobs, and those are things that we need to be cognizant of right now, these theories of violence happening by different populations. So we definitely want to educate the public. We hope that you're able to come out. It's free and open to the public.
We will put all the information about this event on our website at stlpublicradio.org. we've got to scoot. There's so much to talk about and so little time, as they say, but I'm appreciative of all of you being here. We have more on the East St. Louis race riots, by the way, on our St. Louis History and Black and White project on our website at stlpublicradio.org. I want to thank Charles Lumpkins of Pennsylvania State University, Andrew Theising of Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville, and Tiffany Lee. Thank you so much for being with us. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.